So, we were in the middle of talking about tolerant dictionaries. That's what I'm going to do today, first part, and then I will be doing the thing that people have been waiting for, apparently, because every once in a while people will tell me, but then this term is, if you see this term, then probably this other term is going to be present. That means the terms are not independent and the terms are correlated. So we'll do correlation analysis, starting today. And it becomes quite interesting by next class when we get to do dimensionality reduction using latent semantic indexing. Okay? Let's get this. What is the problem here? Okay. So we were looking at, if the user types the word wrong, then you might want to suggest to them other possible words that they might have wanted to type, right? So that was the issue. And the question, of course, is how do we know which word the user wanted to type? The one idea that we were looking at is k-gram analysis. So for example, a word like alone would have, by the way, so when you're writing k-gram, you normally tend to think of two special characters. Yeah, so if you have something like alone, then you assume that it starts with the start character, ends with a end character. Okay, so if you then have to write this as 2 grams, then you have that, those are the 2 grams. Okay, and so each of these is a separate 2 gram. Okay, and then if I then want to, if I wound up writing Alan, then that has right. Okay, so Alan and alone are connected in the sense that you have these elements here. Each of these are like indivisible elements. A bigram is an indivisible element now, and so you can consider this as one set, this as another set. In fact, you can consider them as bags too, because sometimes the same bigram might occur more than once, right? So in fact, we'll assume that they're bags, and then we take the Jaccard similarity between the bags to see whether or not the word is close to the other word, okay? So that's what we are going to do. And then of course, since there are going to be only, so if there are, n different characters in your vocabulary, I mean, so you have 26 characters, right? So then you have n square bigrams, right? N square bigrams and cube trigrams and so on. So essentially, you are now going to be, each of these words can essentially be indexed in terms of the bigrams it contains. And in fact, you can actually compute the inverted index so that at the query time, you can then see what are all the other words which have that particular bigram. So here, the bigram LO occurs in alone, lord, and sloth. And R occurs in border, lord, and morbid, and so on. Okay? So you can actually use this inverted index structure in computing the Jaccard similarity fast. Okay? But if I give you just 2 words, then you can compute the Jaccard similarity just the normal way. If you're doing it on a large number of words, you can use the inverted index structure. Okay. The question, of course, is how do you actually go about using this k-gram distance computation to decide what are the good words? So the basic idea that you plan to do, and let me just go to that slide and then come back here. Sorry. Yeah, so the way you would, I mean, forget about the word edit distance right now. So using k-gram distance, you can think of this slide as using k-gram distance, for example. So the idea would be that you might essentially compute words which are within a certain kgram distance away from the word that the user typed. Okay, those may not be English words. Okay, and then you might then take an intersection of them with the correct words in the lexicon, and then see, you know, which are, and then present those to the user. Now, of course, for the kgram distance, unfortunately, it's not generative. It's not easy to give you all words that are one distance away from a given word. Okay, but we will talk about a different kind of a distance called edit distance, where it does become quite easy to talk about all words that are one distance, one edit distance away from the word. So that's why this is actually said with respect to the edit distance. But the way you wind up using these always is you compute the candidates and then intersect. Okay, that would be the good way to do it. Another way, of course, the other obvious way would, of course, which is actually kind of a naive way, is to compute the k-gram distance for every word in the lexicon and see which one is the closest top k to the word that the user typed. Okay. So now, as I said, in terms of deciding what a correct word is, all you can say, we were discussing last time, is basically you can't just depend on the English dictionary per se, because it's possible that the people are not typing from the English dictionary. They may be typing words that haven't yet entered the dictionary, because dictionaries are always lagging indicators of popular culture. Okay, so really, you actually just look at the inverted index of all the words. And then you see, if you remember from last class, for each inverted index, you have this lexicon in the inverted index, and then for each of the words in the lexicon, the number of records in which, number of documents in which it occurs. Okay, so you can actually see this number is the number of documents where this word occurs. Okay, so in this case, actually, you can say that any word which has reasonable number of occurrences is probably a real word. If it has exactly one occurrence, while it makes it very unique, it also makes it too unique that it's more likely to be a spelling error than anything else. Okay, so you could use, so in some sense you can just look at the entire lexicon as the dictionary, or you can take the subset of the lexicon which is above a certain threshold in terms of number of occurrences and say those might be the words that you're trying to type. Okay. Just going back to where I was. It will take a minute. Okay. So basically, using lexicon of the inverted index itself, and then, you know, the postings list contains how many documents this word occurs, and that kind of gives you whether it's a reasonable, you know, word or not. Okay. One last thing is, of course, are you going to look at the words in the lexicon, which is the set of documents, or the list of queries that people have typed in the past? Okay, that in fact, the documents are even documents are lagging indicator of what people are looking for. The query logs are really the current indicators of what people are looking for. Okay, so in fact, one thing, you know, this is the first time I'll say it here, but in many techniques that we'll discuss from now onwards, they can be applied either to the document corpus or to the query logs. What's a query log? Query log is just the log of all the queries that people have typed. So in a traditional IR sense, a query log basically could be all the paragraph queries that people have typed. So that in itself is a little document corpus. Okay, for search engines like Google, etc., there'll be like 2-3 words that people have typed. But that's again, so it's like a query log is a separate corpus. Documents are what is out there. Query logs are what people are looking for. You can do analysis of them on, in analysis, many types of analysis, either on the query logs or on the document index. And sometimes one is better than the other. The huge big difference is query logs many a time are actually the right thing to analyze. But if you are writing a search engine, where are you going to get your query logs? There is a huge what's called the cold start problem. Okay? Cold start problem basically means if you wrote a search engine, presumably you don't yet have any customers, and so nobody asks queries. So you can go and ask Google, could you please tell me what are the queries people are asking you, and they'll say take a hike. right? So essentially, query logs really are the ones that you want to analyze. Many a time you don't have access to them. Okay, in this case, actually, either of them, both of them are equally good. But then once we start talking about correlations and so on, it turns out that maybe analyzing query log correlations is better than analyzing the document corpus correlations. But you don't have it, you know, rich have it. The 2-3 search engines that actually have, you know, non-zero number of customers might have query logs, and so they get better. Rich get better. Okay, in fact, we'll talk about this very nice idea. Why is it that all my pens are dead? Called power law distributions, which, you know, we'll talk about, we'll have enough time to talk about them, but, you know, which is basically rich get richer. And people who already have query logs can analyze those query logs and become even more customized to the user population. And people who don't have them would like to analyze them, but they have nothing to analyze. Okay, so I don't have any obvious answer for it. I mean, from a technical point of view, this technique works either here or here. If you have both, then you can decide which one to use. Okay, if you only have one, you know which one to use. That's the only one you can use, the document corpus. Okay, so we will mention query logs multiple times, but remember that while it is a great idea, you may not have it. You know, that's a big issue. Okay, so I mentioned k-gram distance. K-gram distance is not generative in the sense, if I give you a word, it's not as easy to develop all the words which are 1 k-gram distance away from this word. Okay, by the way, I'm also saying similarity and distance interchangeably, but that's what I mentioned in one of the mails. You know, similarities are really distance measures. Okay. So we have another distance measure here called, and anytime I come up with a new distance measure, you should ask yourself, is it a distance metric? You know, I mentioned that in one of the mails I sent. A metric will be, you know, symmetric, it would be non-negative, and it would satisfy the triangle law of inequality. Okay, many a time actually distance metrics don't satisfy triangle law of inequality and still people use them. But the good ones certainly, I mean distance measures. For it to be called metric, it should be actually satisfying triangle law of inequality, which, in case you have forgotten, in a triangle, sum of any two sides is larger than the third side. That's it. Larger than or equal to the third side. And become equal when the point of the triangle is on the line itself. So it's all three points are collinear. Okay. So we have one more distance now called edit distance, which is essentially captures the intuition that two strings differ from each other because you're writing them by typing them and you might be making editing mistakes. Okay, so the kind of edit mistakes that you can make are essentially the minimum number of, so you're talking about basic operations. You insert a letter, you delete or you miss a letter, okay, and then so basically, and then you might be able to transpose letters, which we'll talk about later. Okay, so edit distance between string 1 and string 2 is the minimum number of basic operations you need to do to convert one to the other. Why is minimum required? Because otherwise it's not well defined. You know, I can, you know, take on and make it to 1, you know, in a minimal distance, I just need to add insert E. That's one operation. But another way I can do on to 1 is O N W K J R, cut J, cut K, put E, cut W. Okay, if you actually see people typing, you know, instantaneously, they might sometimes be making these mistakes, you know, adding letters and deleting letters, etc. Okay, so you need to talk about minimal distance because that's the only uniquely defined distance. A maximal distance, any distance can be generated. You want 15 as a distance, I will do, you know, if the distance is 5 to begin with, you want it to be 15, I will add 15 random things or 7.5 random things and remove 7.5 random things and I'm done. Okay, so that's why you need minimum. So the insert, the admissible basic operation that people look at are insert, delete, and replace. Those are the main ones. And then there's a distance, edit distance measure called Levenstein edit distance, which only uses those three. So how many insert, delete, replaces do you need to do to go from one to the other? The minimum number, okay? And to be, and all I want is you want to show me when you say 3, then you need to show me those 3 operations that convert this into that. But what I care about is the number 3, and that should be the minimum. Okay? And then there is a variation of Levenstein distance called Dammer law of Levenstein, which essentially adds to these 3 basic operations, the operation of transposition. Okay, again, these are reasonable errors that you can be making if you are typing. Transposition could happen if I'm trying to type T and H, but due to the, you know, due to the slight synchronization problem, I typed H first and T next, instead of T first and H next. So they got transposed. Okay? Yes?
Can you transpose over more than a distance of 1? Like,
no, transposition is main transposition, just H, T, 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 H. Okay, again, the question of whether or not what you consider basic operations really is connected to this notion of what is the error model. What kind of errors do people make? Okay, and you can already see that while I made these basic operations, not all errors are created equal. Not all replaces are created equal. More people tend to replace M with N than M with Z, for example. Okay, so if you want to take that into account, then you get the next slide, which is weighted distance measure. So different, you know, the distance depends on the characters involved. Okay, anyway, so here are some examples. Make sure that you understand this. Levenstein distance between dog and do is 1 because I just need to add G. And between cat and cart is 1 because I just added an R after A. Okay, and cat and cut 1, cat and act is 2. Okay, do you see that? Cat and act is 2 for Levenstein because I'm not allowed to transpose. Okay, so how would you get cat to act in 2? What are the 2 basic operations? Tell me 2 basic operations. I assume somebody said something right. Two replaces, for example. Okay, and then the same one, cat and act, will become distance 1 if it is, if you allow transposition also. Okay, if you assume all of them, in this case you are assuming all errors are equally likely. They're all created equal. Okay, the next one is weighted edit distance, as I said, which is basically the same as before, except the weight of an operation depends on the characters involved. This is a more general case. That one just becomes a special case of this, where it ignores, you know, f of x, y ignores x and y and just gives a number. Okay, that's basically what we're doing here. Okay, now where do you get the weights? In some sense, these weights are supposed to represent the likelihood of errors that people tend to make. Okay, and to the extent all people are basically making the same kinds of error with the same kinds of frequency, then presumably you can just set them up once up front. Okay, you can also try to learn these errors, which we'll talk about at the end, a Bayesian approach for just completely learning spelling correction. Okay, so that's where the weights come from, but we assume for now that the weights are created equal. So weights are just given up front. So here you need way more weights. The previous one is just, you know, all the errors are created equal, so it's just, you know, you say each basic operation is 1 costly, 1 distance. Okay, now the one interesting question, although I'm not going to spend time on this here, is it's not how easy or hard is it to compute. You were able to compute the distances here quite easily. But it's actually not easy, not as obvious, to compute the minimum distance between 2 words. It's still polynomial, it turns out, but you can make it exponential if you are not careful. Okay, so to get an example, consider this sentence, this word umbrella, and then umbrellat. Yeah, that's what, yeah, this is the same thing, umbrellat and umbrella. Okay, so what is the distance between them? The point to understand is the distance. Okay, so if you are trying to align them like this, if you try to align them like this, then it looks like U and M, it's already 1 distance. Okay, and M and B, 1 more distance, B and E, B and R, and so on. So this looks like a large amount of basic operations to convert the top one to bottom one. But if you align it such that you push this underneath that, then you realize that actually the distance is just 1. You missed 1 character. So in this case, yeah, okay, and also the T was added. Okay? Now the point is, in general, I could basically have situations where there's a alignment for a particular sequence, optimal alignment for a particular sequence, followed by some junk, followed by another optimal alignment. Okay, and it's not obvious. I can give you long sequences and make you compute the minimum distance, and you won't be happy with me. It turns out that, thankfully, how many of you have heard of dynamic programming algorithms? Okay, you should have heard about them in 3.10. In fact, it's easy to write, not very easy, but easy to write a dynamic programming algorithm for string distance computation, which would be of complexity m times n. And the algorithm actually itself is given in the chapter on tolerant dictionaries that I sent you as possible reading for this part. Okay, so you can look at that. So the point, of course, is optimal alignment. Distance depends on the optimal alignment, and you need to both align and compute the distance at the same time. Okay, while I'm not giving you the algorithm, I do want to say that some of this gets done multiple times in other places. For example, sequence alignment task in genetics. Okay. If you're talking about long words, English is child's play. German is serious, because German basically, and actually one of the languages I know, Sanskrit, which is sort of the Latin of the Indian languages. It too is dead, nobody uses it, but it's like the root of most of the Indian languages. In both Sanskrit and in German, you can essentially combine multiple words into a super word. And so there are no spaces, and so it becomes, I don't even know what it's called in German, but in Sanskrit it's called samasa, which is basically just connected set of words, and you are just supposed to read the whole thing together. And those of us who need spaces to figure out where the word is ending, we're in trouble. And furthermore, then actually, first of all, notice that when any languages with this super word structure, segmentation is important. Otherwise, all of a sudden, your vocabulary increases arbitrarily large, because you're taking the same basic words and adding them together to get a new word. Okay, now, neither of these are particularly bad compared to genetics, where the words are actually just what? Four, right? And then you just keep repeating them in multiple random sequences, and there may be small noises in between. Right, and you want to see what is the optimal alignment of this gene to this other gene. What's the number of distance, what's the edit distance? In fact, you might be interested in seeing what kinds of mutations are more likely versus less likely, and that's the distance that you would be computing. Okay, and so essentially computing the sequence alignment problem is again a dynamic programming problem, and it's just that you think m times n, m is the word length, n is the word length, words are small enough, it's okay. And they look at word m times n, oh my god, m is one gene, n is another gene, and it's basically long, long strings. Okay? One other place where this actually gets used is speech recognition. If I give you the, if I give you the speech signal for some word, I said it, and you said the same word, you may have expanded the time scale. You may have contracted the time scale. You may have added little extra noise in between. And what I need to see whether the word you said is the same as one of the words in the dictionary, I need to first optimally align these two signals and then compute the distance. And that is called dynamic time warping. So you're dynamically changing the time scales, saying the first part, this guy elongated it, and the second part, he reduced the time, and the third part again elongated it. I get to say any which way I want, and people still try to understand, right? This kind of distance computation is actually quite an interesting thing. We just touch it here in the tolerant dictionaries. And as I said, edit distances are very interesting, because I can always generate, given a sequence, it's fairly easy to generate all strings that are one distance away from this string. So I'll consider all one insertions, then I'll consider all the one deletions, then I'll consider all the one replaces, and so I'll get a huge number of these things, but it's still finite. Okay, only one distance, right? And so now, if I get a word, then I can compute the set of sequences that are one edit distance away from it. And then you know, intersect this list with my lexicon to see if any of these words are actually real words. If so, then I can suggest it to my user saying, did you potentially want to say this word instead of the word that you said? Do you see what I'm saying? Okay? And so basically you need to put some kind of a threshold on the distance. And people who write completely different stuff, you know, you can't help them. But if you assume that, you know, a few errors would be made, like one or two edit errors could be made, then I can essentially look at the sequence you gave me, consider two error universe of strings around this. That's a huge set. Intersect it with my lexicon, and that will give me, you know, which of these strings are nonsensical and which of them have entries in the dictionary. And like as I said, eventually people are checking, especially if you're doing things on, you know, because web is adversarial, random words. If people are searching for the word, believe me, other people put documents that have those words in them. How many times have you typed something and you are so surprised to see that such a thing already exists, and you go there and they basically have a definition, quote unquote, for that word. Mostly they want to show you advertisements. Okay? How did they do this? They are essentially looking at queries that people are asking, and you generate, you know, pages which basically have those words in them. And there is no meaning to that, those pages. The only reason that page is there is to get people like you to come to that page. Okay, so eventually there is no such thing as mistyping, because if you think of mistyping as being not present in lexicon, everything will eventually be present in lexicon. That's why you need to consider the number of occurrences. But then since the whole thing is adversarial, maybe even that will go out. Maybe eventually we get to a point where real words occur less often than the made up words. At which point we'll speak those words. Right? Right? I mean, we change spellings. I mean, you know, English used to have pretty crazy spelling, as it does. Already it has pretty crazy spelling. And then if enough high school students are failing because of spelling mistakes, you know, they grow up, become OED, the Webster Dictionary editors, and they say, we don't want this spelling for this word. We'll change it. And then so we'll change the language too. But anyway, so that's the adversarial aspect of that part. Okay. The last thing I wanted to say here, actually I won't spend too much time on this, maybe later I would do it, is there's a really nice way, a more unified way to do this kind of approach, this kind of error correction, which is basically a Bayesian account. Okay, and so the idea there, how many of you know Bayes' rule? Not too many. So we will probably do Bayes' rule later on. We will do Bayes' rule later on.
I thought you said baseball.
Baseball, oh. That would be even fewer people, actually. Bayes' rule. Bayes' rule is not about baseball, but if you don't know Bayes' rule, then we will talk about Bayes' rule at a later point, and then we'll talk about this again at that time. It turns out that there's actually a much nicer way of thinking about this whole problem. If you basically what they're doing there is you're trying to compute the probability that somebody who wanted to type W typed C. Oh no, wait, one second. You're given W, so you looked at, you typed W, what is the probability that the correct word that you wanted to type is C? That's what you're trying to compute. Across all the words C in the lexicon, what is the word that you wanted to type? In some sense, this is also the kind of thing that, you know, it turns out that Bayesian approaches can also be used for information retrieval. We did not get into it, you know, but it actually can be used. And when you're spelling correcting sequences, you can also word correct queries. And so Lincoln could have used this to figure out that the guy who asked how long should a man's legs be, he actually used this kind of an analysis to figure out, oh, you want your son to be pardoned. Okay? So essentially, if you wrote the W as a word, what's the probability that you meant to say C? And that, using Bayes' rule, is the probability that if you wanted to say the correct word C, you would type W, times the probability of the word C itself, divided by the probability of word W. Okay. Now, of these, the PW given C is what? So, if you wanted to type a particular word, what's the probability that you will type this other word? That's the error model. So, in some sense, PW given C is what you are capturing by all these distance metrics. Edit distance, k-gram distance, and so on. But instead of computing syntactic distances, you can just look at the training data and see any time, you know, somebody wanted to say Rav, they are always, you know, constantly saying some completely different word, computer, let's say. So then, for them, it's very likely that when they say computer, they meant Rav. And from a syntactic distance point of view, computer is very far away from Rav. But you don't care about syntactic distance. You want to care about what your users, what are the errors your users are likely to make. Okay? And so, you know, the error model is P, what is the probability that you will type W when you meant C. Different kinds of errors, including letter swapping, etc., have different probabilities. And you are essentially, you can learn this error model from data, from, you know, observing people making errors. Okay, and then the C is, probability of C is the prior probability that the word C is actually used by a random person. Okay, so there are some words that are like high GRE vocabulary. People don't use them except in GRE and SAT exams, right? And so even if you think that the word they type is very close to anti-disestablishmentaristic or something, you know, you might want to ask yourself, how likely is it that somebody will actually type such a word? So that's the prior that anybody would actually want to type that word. So even if it's highly likely that you have the, you know, anti-disestablishmentaristic seems to be a possibly very likely error that you could have made, its ranking should be reduced because it's a very unlikely word to begin with. Okay, and so if I can compute P of C from the document corpus, are the words that people type. I can compute errors by looking at both the words people wanted to type and people the words that people typed. And then I can use that, I can plug that in to actually compute what's the maximally likely word that, you know, people wanted to type when they type W. Right? Now, suppose C is the disease you are suffering from. W is your symptoms. Okay? So I have runny nose. What's the probability that I have Ebola disease? Okay? Actually, I mean, Ebola virus, you know, infection kind of a thing. Now, people who have Ebola infection, I mean, I don't know if you've seen any of these graphic movies, you know, if you have Ebola, everything is running, not just your nose, right? In fact, your entire body is running. So basically, Ebola virus does explain that that's one possible disease I could be suffering from when I went with a runny nose. So is common cold. So is allergy. Now, why is it that as soon as you walk into a doctor's office, they don't start treating you with Ebola virus vaccinations? Partly because they're not there, but partly also, and also because the insurance won't cover it, and mostly because probability that a random person in Tempe area would be suffering from Ebola infection is very small, and probability that they're more like that they're going to be suffering from allergy is much higher. Flu close to 1.0, right? And so essentially, it's the prior that makes the ranking be correct. Once again, and there is this idea called fallacy of prior, which is again a diversion here. As I said, you know, this Bayesian analysis is like diagnosis. You're diagnosing what the disease is given the symptoms. W is the symptom that you typed. C is the true disease that you wanted, that you're suffering from, the word that you wanted to express. Okay, and the same theory works for diagnosis of diseases, diagnosis of words, the correct words that you wanted to type, and so on. And as long as we're talking about diseases, the interesting thing is that most of you now, I mean, those of you who are advancing in ages, maybe not all of you, I do it anyway. You know, if you're having some symptoms, you go off to internet and type your symptoms and see what are all the diseases that I could be suffering from. And then, of course, you know, as usual, the, you know, the television commercials say, please go to the doctor and ask, can I take this medicine? right? Apparently, that's what we are supposed to do, to go to the doctor and say, I already decided this bag of medicines might be looking good for me. Would you like me to take this, right? The question with that is, why do people make mistakes? Why is it that when they go on to internet with their symptoms, they tend to basically find pretty horrendous diseases that they are definitely likely suffering from? Well, if you go, if you have a runny nose, you go and check runny nose. Runny nose is indexed under a whole bunch of diseases, you know, including Ebola infection. So yeah, it looks like that's probably what I'm doing. Yeah.
Because it has PC and PW as equal for everything.
Exactly. More than PW, it's like the piece. The point is that the priors are not known to you. You don't know which diseases are more likely, which are less likely. All diseases are 10 power minus 15 anyway. I mean, 10 power minus, 7 or something. If they're not, big diseases are not all that likely, okay? And some of them, even the 10 power minus 7 versus 10 power minus 12, it makes a big difference. And you don't know that. Your doctor who has, gone into loans, big loans for going through the medical school, they have a better idea. So this is what they'll tell you. They basically give you, now that there's internet, you can, diagnose yourself, except you over-diagnose yourself, okay? So that's called the fallacy of prior. People wind up, and the fallacy of prior for you would be that, the word, you assume that all words are created equal, all correct words are created equal, and so you're more likely to say, oh, you meant to say this highfalutin GRE word, and this person is probably, second standard dropout, and probably did not have that word anywhere in their mind, okay? So these can be learned, and this is a Bayesian way of looking at spelling correction, and you can actually think about Bayesian way of doing information retrieval itself. There's entire chapters in the IR textbook that was one of the readings. There is probabilistic models of information retrieval that you can look at if you're interested. Okay, so I'll stop for that here and move on to my next topic for today's class, which is start improving on the vector similarity metric. Remember, we did vector similarity, and we did some obvious improvements to it, such as improving the term weights, okay? And then we talked about how the indexing and retrieval works so that you can actually implement it in a large scale, a reasonably large scale, and then you now can do your, project one. Now I'm going to talk about how to improve vector similarity. Obviously, some of the problems you already have seen before, which is here is a bunch of problems. Okay, document representation loses information. Of course, you took a document and made it into a bag of words or a vector of words, lost information. User's inability to describe queries precisely. They don't know what they want and they'll just write something. These are all the problems with the current approach that we are using. Similarity function use may not be good enough. We liked the vector similarity, but that's just a syntactic measure. Importance, weight of a term in representing a document and the query may be inaccurate. We tried to improve it using TF-IDF, but that's sort of an approximation. And the same term might have multiple meanings, and different terms may have similar meanings. So synonymy and polysemy. Okay, synonymy basically means you asked for a word, but that word isn't present in this particular document, but a synonym of that word is present. Maybe you would be happy with this document. Okay? And polysemy, you asked for a word, it's present in this document, but you probably meant it in a different sense. My favorite example is, if I ask for a word Bush, I could be looking for George Bush, or Kalahari Bushmen, or, Burning Bush, or anything. Okay? And so the question is, each one word has multiple different contexts, okay? On top of all this, in fact, if you look at, and even if you actually assume that vector is a reasonable representation, we have this issue that vector dimensions are not independent, they might be correlated. And interestingly, while we can't solve all these problems, we will look at, what did I do? Okay. We will look at three extensions, of which the first one I won't do today, and in fact I won't do it right now, I'll do it later, and the other two I will do it starting today. So one is this idea called relevance feedback, which tries to figure out what the user really wanted to say by having a bit of a conversation with the user. Okay, approximate idea basically is that the user gives a query, so then you go off and take, you know, generate 30 documents according to your best guess and show it to the user. And you ask the user, please tell me which of these are relevant, which are irrelevant. By that time, most users would have left, but assume that you have good users who like to help you out. So they'll say, these are relevant, these are irrelevant. Now they ask, give me the next 10 documents for the same query. So then I can improve my query now by realizing that, you know, for this query, documents D1, D3, D4 are relevant, D7, D8, D9 are irrelevant. And so how do I change the query such that documents more like these will come and less like these? I mean, more like these and less like these will come. That's relevant feedback, okay? And that's sort of like in search engines, you say similar pages like this, and you click on it, you'll get more pages like that particular document. That's the same sort of an idea. It is a very simple syntactic thing, actually. I almost cannot stop myself from giving it away, which is that if you have a query Q, and then here are the documents D1 to DK that are relevant, and here are the documents D-1 to D-J that are irrelevant, then what I can say is query is a vector. These are all vectors. I can compute the centroid of these vectors. The centroid of a vector, centroid of multiple vectors is just add up all of the vectors in the corresponding dimension divided by the number of vectors. That would be the centroid. Okay? So that would be sort of the mean vector, the average vector that is relevant. And then I can also compute the average vector that is irrelevant. Okay? So then I take the query vector Q, add to it the average vector that is relevant, subtract from it the average vector that's irrelevant. Okay? In fact, I could say ignore query altogether. Now that you asked me a query, but you now gave me much more information about what is relevant, what is irrelevant. So I will just use this itself. Okay? And there are variations where you will do alpha times query Q plus 1 minus alpha times this whole thing. Okay, we will look at it again as a very simple idea for doing learning over text documents, which are represented as vectors. Okay? The second idea is correlation analysis, which is certain words go together. Okay? And certain words, basically, so if I say this word, even if I didn't say it, I also meant these other words. So can I then find out which are the words that belong together? Computer science, data structure, database. Okay, can I compute these correlations myself? So in some sense, they are functional synonyms. When you see this word, you expect to see this other word right next to it almost. Okay, that's correlation analysis. And finally, we'll talk about something that subsumes correlation analysis called principal component analysis, which does dimensionality reduction, but I'll get to that there. Okay, so correlation and co-occurrence. So terms that are related to terms in the original query. So if I were to be able to do correlation analysis, what can I use it for? So if I give a word and my query, I might be able to add more words that are relevant, that are similar to those words, or that are kind of, you know, correlated with those words. Okay, so I may be able to use it to expand my query, essentially. Okay, and by expanding the query, then I make the query more precise, because if you allow the user, so you say bush. Right? And if I were to suggest to you, here are some functional synonyms, burning, George, Kalahari. Do you like to add any of these words? Okay? And so I then say burning, then obviously burning bush is my query, not George Bush. How did I figure out that when I said bush, when the user said bush, I should be able to show these three words as the possibly correlated words? That's basically because they're occurring together more often than any two random words. Okay? So two terms are related if they have high co-occurrence in the documents. Okay? Let me look at this. Just 1 second. Okay, so here is an example of correlation. There are 1,000 documents in my corpus. a particular word K1 is in present in 25% of them. Another word K2 is present, actually unfortunately assume, is in present in 25. Actually this, let's change this word thing actually and say assume that K1 is present in 50% of them, K2 is present in 50% of them, because that's the example that I want to use. Okay, simpler to understand. K1 is present in 50%, K2 is present in 50%. My question is, are these words correlated? If you did not, if you thought you know the answer, then you are in trouble. Okay, you clearly don't know, right? What if I tell you K1 is present in 100% of the documents, K2 is present in 100% of the documents, then of course they are correlated, fully correlated, because you know they are present in every one of the documents. But you know, anything below 50, basically you can't actually tell. Based on this, I can still make them be correlated or uncorrelated. In terms of correlation, it could be positively correlated or negatively correlated. And if they are not correlated at all, either positively or negatively, then they are independent. Okay? To be able to tell, then I need to ask you, basically I need to tell you, what percentage of documents do contain both K1 and K2 together. That's what I need to tell you. Okay? Suppose I said X percent of the document contain K1 and K2 together. Then based on the X, K1 and K2 can be positively correlated, negatively correlated, or independent. First question, if two keywords are independent, is it possible that a document can contain both of them?
Yes.
Okay, please remember this. Okay, I mean, again, as I'm saying, people tend to think that independence means no overlap. Independence actually, if, in fact, whenever you see me, you don't see my alter ego, that's because we are correlated. When I'm here, the alter ego is not here. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you never see word 2 ever with word 1, they're actually correlated. They're just correlated negatively. Correlation is your ability to predict the other word based on the presence of this word. So if, you know, I have an enemy and I and my enemy never go to parties together, like Seinfeld and Newman, let's say. So if Seinfeld is in the party, you don't need to look to see if Newman is there. You assume Newman is more likely not there. Okay? So that's negative correlation, but it's predictive. Whereas if Seinfeld is present, would some other random person be present? I don't know. I need to look. And that is independence. Independence is where you have no predictive power. Okay, so for this, the X percent would be, if it is 25%, right, then essentially that's independence case. Okay, and if it is less than 25%, significantly less than 25%, they are negatively correlated. Significantly greater than 25%, they are positively correlated. Right, okay, and of course you can actually make sense of this from the point of view of conditional probabilities. Probability of K1 and K2 is probability of K1 times probability of K2 given K1. Or probability of K2 times probability of K1 given K2. Right? And so the time when you say two things are independent is PK2 given K1 is nothing but P of K2. Prior probability of K2, probability of K2 given that K1 is present is the same as the prior probability of K2. Okay, that's why when they are independent, you will just assume that P of K1 times P of K2. By the way, just to put a little connection back to the previous couple of slides back, previous slide, Bayes basically looked at this formula. That's it. Okay, they said, well, the K1, K2 can be represented as probability of K1 times K2 given K1. Probability of K2 times K1 given K2, which means probability of K2 given K1 can be written as probability of K1 given K2 times probability of K2 by probability of K1. And for this bit of amazing algebra, the guy is famous, hugely famous. And we'll actually understand partly why such a very useful, you know, insight. But we'll understand even more if you take, you know, AI course or probabilistic reasoning course as to why Bayes analysis is quite different from normal statistics. But anyway, this is Bayes rule that is, you know, basically just a way of equating two ways of writing a joint probability in terms of conditional probabilities and then computing one in terms of that. That's it. Okay? Anyway, so correlations you understood now, right? And in this case, 25 and 32, that would basically be 8%, 25 times 32. Okay? And so if it is greater than 8%, it's positive. Less than 8%, it's negative. Approximately 8%, it's independent. Yes? What? No, this is basically because what I told you was the prior probabilities. When I said K1 is occurring in 50% of the documents, P of K1 is 0.5. So K2 is occurring in 50% of the documents, P of K2 is 0.5. So I'm asking you to compute P of K1 and K2. Which you will try to compute using this. This always works. But when they are independent, this is just P of K2. Right? So that's the thing. That's the point about independence and dependence. Yes?
Just because P of K1 and K2 is equal to P of K1 into P of K2, you can't still tell that it's...
That's the definition of independence. That's how you figure out two things are independent is because in a large enough sample, the definition of independent events, K1 and K2 are independent. If they are independent, then their joint probability is probability of K1 times probability of K2. And one way of thinking about it is, independence model is, here are all the document buckets. Okay, one guy comes and pours K1 randomly. And another guy comes and pours K2 randomly. These two guys don't know each other at all. Okay. So they cannot coordinate in any which way. Unless they're putting one in each of the buckets, essentially they're likely to be, unless there is some kind of a correlation in the way they're pouring the keywords into the documents, they're going to be independent. Yes?
What if the data changes? Like, what
what do you mean?
How come we know that it'll maintain the same property?
No, I'm just saying, given a particular corpus, would you say it is independent or not? That's all I'm saying. Okay? So with respect to the current corpus, the prior probability of K1 is some number, probability of K2 is another number, probability of K1 and K2 is a third number. If they satisfy P of K1, K2 is P of K1 times P of K2, then it is independent. Otherwise, they are correlated. Okay? Yes?
In the Bush example, when you gave on those three words to one, they should be correlated.
They could be both positive and negatively correlated.
But between them, it's better that they are independent, right?
No, why? No, I would never want to add independent words to the query because it doesn't increase the quality of the query.
No, I mean between those three, the independence between they.
If they are independent, that basically means there is no connection between them.
But it means that they are closer.
No. Independent is basically means how much ever I tell you about how many instances of the word bush is present in this document, your estimate of whether a word burning will be present is not going to change. Okay? Let's take this out of the class. Okay? So what I'm going to do is, so this is basically what I'm saying, that you know, if I have a document corpus with n documents, then if a particular word occurs in N1 of them, then its prior probability is N1 by N. If another thing occurs in N2 of them, the probability of that is N2 by N. And then the fraction of the documents in which they would occur together using independence assumptions would be N times these two. That's the expected number of documents where both these words will occur. If the number of documents where they occur is either greater than or less than this M, then they are correlated. They can be positively or negatively correlated. This is the analysis that we will wind up doing, essentially, to compute the correlation. Okay. Now, to do this, actually, we will, rather than just do it piece by piece, one word at a time, we will use the vector description of the words and the documents. And this is actually the first place where, remember, we were talking about what's the big difference between documents as bags versus documents as vectors? this is a good place where, in fact, that difference, you know, is in favor of vectors. Okay, so here is what you saw, right? This is document term matrix. Okay, so I'm sorry, no, this is term document matrix. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I are the documents, and these are the terms. Okay, from now onwards, we'll always write, you know, these are matrices, right? So I will write TD to mean a term document matrix, and DT to mean document term matrix, one of which is the transpose of the other. That's it. Okay, just inserting M and N, etc., which have no meaning. So this one is a TD matrix. In the TD matrix, each row corresponds to a term, and each column corresponds to a document. In the DT matrix, the opposite. You know, each row corresponds to a document, each column corresponds to a term. Now, until now, we've been focusing on the possibility that each document is a vector in the space of terms. But I can equally say each term is a vector in the space of documents. I can't do this as well for bags. You see, each Rao's bag is a collection of fruits. Each fruit is not a collection of bags. You see what I'm saying? So the metaphor doesn't go well there. Whereas here, in fact, in terms of the vectors, it's like, you know, matrices. Remember, this is the time to bring back all your linear algebra. You have row space and column space for matrices. And they have relations between row spaces and column spaces. In this particular case, you have the documents are in the vectors in the space of terms. Terms are vectors in the space of documents. Okay. So now I basically can, so first remember that and think about the following question. Suppose the terms were really independent, then here is an interesting thing. Suppose I take the matrix TD, okay, multiply it by matrix TD prime, the TD transpose. Okay, that would be TD times DT. And, you know, this much at least you know about matrices, it will become TT matrix. Term-term matrix. Okay, so if I multiply TD by TD dash, TD by TD transpose, I will get a matrix which is a square matrix, square symmetric matrix, which computes essentially the correlations between terms. Okay, and remember that matrix multiplication, actually, how many of you already know that matrix multiplication can be understood in terms of vector dot products? You better understand this. Okay, matrix multiplication is not just a random formula that you think. Basically, what you're doing is, if I have a matrix like this, right, this is row 1, and I'm multiplying it by this other matrix which has column 1, so the final matrix, the answer matrix, this term would be this row dot product this column, right? So multiplication is just a series of dot products. Isn't that cute? Now, okay, remember, this is the term vector. TD matrix, this row will be the term vector. DT matrix, this column would be the term vector. When I multiply two vectors, I mean these two documents, then I will get here these two term vectors dot product. In fact, ijth term in the multiplication would be ti dot tj. The vectors ti dot tj. It's just dot products. Now here's my question. Remember, we all assumed that terms are supposed to be independent? If terms are independent, their vectors should be independent. If two vectors are independent, basically that means they're orthogonal. If they're orthogonal, their dot product should be zero. And so, if in fact you were really right and you were not delusional when you thought that terms are all independent, then when you computed the term-term matrix, you should get a nice diagonal matrix, where there are non-zero entries only on the diagonals. Everything else should be zeros. That's when you know that the terms are independent. Do you see how we connected the notion of vectors, to the notion of independence of vectors to the notion of correlation of terms. Okay, so if in fact they were independent, then the multiplication should give me a multiplied matrix which is TT, which is of the size the number of terms by number of terms, where only the documents would be non-zero and they would correspond to T1 dot product T1, T2 dot product T2, T3 dot product T3, T4 dot product T4. If there are only four terms, that would be the one. Everything else should be zero. To the extent the rest of the things are not zero, that must be because they are correlated. Do you see what I'm saying? And then I can use the non-zeroness of, you know, so for example, for each row, T1's row, you know, T1 would be most correlated to itself. I want to see what else is it more correlated to. Everything else is zero, that means it's completely uncorrelated with everything else. If one of the terms is more correlated, then I'm happy. Then I would say that's your functional equivalent. This is the idea I will start with. Okay? So suppose I have this. I know that I skipped, but you know, we'll come back to this next class. I skipped one slide in between. Suppose I have term document matrix like this. Okay? So if I do term document times term document dash, which is a matrix multiplication, I get this matrix. Trust me on this. You can actually go and check it yourself. But that's the matrix you'll get. And it has size 3 by 3 because there are only 3 terms. And you do notice that these numbers are large in every row. If in any row the diagonal element is not large, then that means those terms have self-esteem problems. They are less similar to themselves than they are to other terms. Right? Right? So in every row, the diagonal elements in that row would be the largest. And so in this row, for example, I can say 11, 4, 6. So 11 is, of course, the term is more similar to itself. If I have to pick one term, that is next, you know, one closest term, then I'll pick the 6, as of now. Okay? The only other question is, can I normalize it? Can I normalize it such that basically the size of these diagonal elements really would depend upon how many times the words are present in the corpus. Whether or not two words are correlated doesn't depend on how often each of them is present in the corpus. So I have a word which is present in 0.00001% of the documents, another word which is also present in 0.0001% of the documents, but they are perfectly correlated. That means in every document where this occurs, this also occurs. Capturing correlation is different from capturing how frequent each of the words is. So what I really want to do is do some sort of a normalization where all of these become ones, so that each term is expected to be most similar to itself, and let's assume the similarity is one, and then normalize it such that everything else is with respect to that. And we'll see next class that one way of doing this is essentially think in terms of you normalize it by saying correlation of UV, which is the term UV in this matrix, divided by correlation of a term to itself, plus correlation of the other term to itself, minus correlation of each of those terms. Because when you compute this, in some sense, think of it as computing the union, and then you have to subtract the intersection because the intersection gets counted twice. Right? So if I do CUV by CUU plus CVV minus CUV for this, you know, you can go back and look at it, I'll get this document, this matrix. Here, essentially, everything is 1, 1, 1. And in this particular case, it so happens that actually the most closest element to this term is still this. So if I'm looking for one most similar element to T1, I would pick this. And one more similar element to this guy, I'll pick this. One more similar element to this guy, I'll pick this. So I have computed correlation. Okay? We would not do any of this right now, but I want to show you. Well, I went away actually. Actually, how many of you have started typing, an email address, and then Google tries to tell you maybe you want to send mails to these other people too? How do you think it's done? This is one idea. if you are always sending mails to people, certain set of group of people, then even if you are trying to send only one of them, Google will say, maybe you want to send it to these other people. You should thank goodness that it doesn't actually complete it. Because in which case, if you're sending one of your best friends very bad things about your second best friend, you know, it's good that they don't know each other. Okay? But this is basically correlation analysis. We'll, you know, continue where we left off next class.